Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com. That's timeforanawakening.com. And listen to the program streaming live from the website. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com. That's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com. /timeforanawakening and listen to the program streaming live there. Or you can download TuneIn. TuneIn is a free app, and you can tune in to any of your devices, your laptop, your desktop, your iPad, your iPhone, tablet. Download TuneIn, and in that search engine of TuneIn, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can listen to the program streaming live there, and you can even stream it into your car. That's Time for Awakening with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. That's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In the Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily. And before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and also Time for Awakening Media has been launched. Just make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. Just type in timeforanawakening.com. That's timeforanawakening.com. It will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. There you'll see more interesting content, blogs, articles, podcasts of the programs that you can download, listen at later times, or even share with your friends. So again, make that one of your favorites and put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight, two special guests scheduled to join us. Percussionist, jazz producer, Mr. Joe Harrison will join us this evening. April is Jazz Appreciation Month, and Mr. Harrison is putting on a program this weekend. And he'll talk about the program and talk a little bit about jazz, an original art form that we brought to this country, that we, along with other things, we'll be talking about jazz with Mr. Joe Harrison in the first portion of the program. In the second portion of the program, we'll be talking about the black contributions to early Philadelphia, a history of our folks' existence here in the city of Philadelphia, and past and present. And we'll be talking about it with historian and musician himself, Mr. Joe Becton, will join us in the second hour of Time for Awakening. So two special guests will be joining us this evening, and we'll be right back to get things started after a brief word from our sponsors.
our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started this evening, I want to bring my co-host in, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American History Museum. Brother Richard is with me on the line. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir. How you doing, Brother Elliot?
How are you, sir?
Great. It seems like we're going to have another powerful kind of dialogue and learning exchange, especially dealing with this, both subjects, jazz and the history of Black Philadelphia, which is, really, really important when you talk about the development of Africans in America, and being able to see the creative aspect and also the historical perspective, both alive and well.
It should be a very interesting discussion with both of our guests. But before I bring in our first guest, Mr. Joe Harrison, I'd like to read a couple of announcements. It's a function going on tomorrow, April the 22nd, later on in the evening. Philly panel discussion is Saturday, April 22nd, 3 to 6 p.m. at the Black Writers Museum, which is at the Vernon House at 5800 Germantown Avenue. The topic, Naturals Need Love Too, Relationship 101, a panel discussion and dinner. It's $25, swag bags for the first 20 people who register. It's a fundraiser for the Locks Conference and a tribute to Sharon Goodman and Nana Ansa Wilson Bay. So again, it's a panel discussion, Naturals Need Love Too, Relationship 101, panel discussion and dinner at the Black Writers Museum. It's a fundraiser for the Locks Conference, which will be held this October. I'm more than sure it'll be in October, but we'll have We'll have folks on Mama Kosovo and others talking about that at a later time. But that panel discussion, again, is at the Black Writers Museum. It's at the Vernon House, 5800 Germantown Avenue. That's Saturday, April 22nd, 3 to 6 p.m. But earlier in that day, Jazz Appreciation Month. April is Jazz Appreciation Month, and we're winding down April. And it's an event going on, a celebration of legendary jazz saxophonist Mr. Sam Reed. Also vocals by Suzanne Burgess and young phenom Yusuf Ali and friends. Saturday, April 22nd, 12 noon to 4 p.m. at Canaan Baptist Church. That's 5430 Pulaski Avenue in Philadelphia. The admission is $20, but children 17 and under are absolutely free. My Blue Heaven food vendor will be there, along with African Marketplace. Those things will be starting early, and the celebration for Mr. Sam Reed will be going on from 12 noon to 4 p.m. at Canaan Baptist Church. And the organizer and producer of that program is with us on the line to talk about that program, to talk about Jazz Appreciation Month, and to talk about jazz in general. I want to welcome to the program jazz percussionist, Mr. Joe Harrison. Brother Harrison, are you with us?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. How you doing?
I'm all right, my good brother. Nice to meet you, Mr. Brother Richard and Elliot. You're a real treasure to the Philadelphia area and nationally with your show. It's a great, great, great medium and forum.
Well,
but let me tell you.
Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I'll let you know that April is Jazz Appreciation Month, and it's important that we celebrate our culture. So jazz is an African-American art form, and so we should celebrate ourselves. So this is what I'm seeking out to do. So I'm going to ask folks to join us at the Jazz Lives, the Spirit Lives Through Jazz Fellowship. What we're doing here, we're celebrating generations in jazz with legendary saxophonist Sam Reed. So, this type of show is really kind of like the African spirit that we're still here. You know what I mean? So you can kill a dream or an idea, but you can't kill the spirit. The people may die, but the spirit lives. So we're celebrating generation in jazz with the legendary Sam Reed and the soothing vocals of Suzanne Burgess and the young phenom, the brother's name is Yase Ali. And so I'm bridging the gap between the young and the more seasoned players. So you can see the passing of the torch, that the spirit is still alive and well with this young brother, Yase, on saxophone, and his friends and his band. He put together a great band. So this takes place tomorrow, Saturday, April 22nd. The doors open at noon. The first jazz set starts at 1, but I have some housekeeping things going on. A young brother saying a poem at 12:30 or so. A young sister, CC Dash from church, will sing a couple of tunes. And the jazz will start at 1 o'clock at Canaan Baptist Church, the gem of Germantown, 5430 Pulaski Avenue. And Naomi, the chef from My Blue Heaven, she's having stuffed chicken breasts. It was Parmesan seasoned stuffed chicken breasts. It sounds phenomenal. And we also have grilled salmon with grilled vegetables. It was a high-class event for a nominal, for fair price. I mean, chicken is $11 for a chicken dinner, and the salmon is going to be $12. We have a peach cobbler and tea and everything, so it's nice. The ladies, my sister from church, so the Donna decorated the place really well. It's going to be beautiful. So I'm excited about tomorrow. I drove by there today. It's going to be very, very nice.
Joe, how many years have you been having this jazz celebration? Because I know you've been doing other events centering around jazz, but this particular one for Jazz Appreciation Month, this is not the first year. How many years have you been doing this?
Well, it hasn't been tons. Okay, I did two celebrations at my church early in the sanctuary, and we did a couple of years ago. I did two, and this is actually the first one I've done like this,
okay.
This format up in the fellowship hall. So it was a little bit different because the other ones were like gospel meets jazz. So they had more of a Christian bent to it, which is still our culture, you know. So it was gospel meets jazz. That was The pastor, our dear Pastor Brennan, said, I said, Pastor, can we do straight up jazz upstairs? He said, yeah, we can do jazz upstairs. As long as, it's positive. And that's what this is. The music is positive. We can do jazz. And this is it's not the sanctuary. It's basically a gym with a stage. So we got that going on up there. Got a sound and everything is going to be great. This is actually the first one like this.
Okay.
The first one like this. I'm looking to do another one in October. But let me get through this one first.
Joe, you're a jazz percussionist yourself. Talk about how long you've been playing music. And then I want to kind of get into a little background history of jazz and bringing it up to the present. Go ahead. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'll tell you a little bit about myself. Well, I've had the status of my life when I've been around as part of our culture, our Black American culture. So, growing up in Philly, I always liked to dance and going to clubs and partying and everything. So I used to enjoy dancing and I also enjoyed singing. So that's kind of what I did, but more dancing when I was a kid. I played bongos and so forth and so on, but being in Philly is very rich in Black culture. I went to Tuskegee, and then I was in a dance theater in Tuskegee. So I toured around like Alabama, different places. My teacher was Diane Robertson. She was from, she I taught at American Ballet Theater, Dance Theater Harlem, in Alvin Ailey. So I did that. I did the dance in college. So, when I did a little classes when I came back to Philly, then I did church choirs. So as I evolved, I started singing in church more. I started singing. One time I was like 3 or 4 choirs a week. So always kind of and steeped into the culture. About, I'll say, 15 years ago, when I had my child, my first child, I couldn't go to jazz clubs. Me and my wife couldn't go hang out to jazz clubs like I used to because I had a baby. So I basically bought congas, and I started playing about 15 years ago. So I knew the rhythm because it's in you because of your culture and your surrounding. So I started taking lessons. And I said, maybe I have a little something here. And I studied with Doc Gibbs, Omar Hill, Juan Castellanos. So I had teachers, and now with the Internet, you can learn a lot of stuff with the Internet. In addition to getting real teachers, Orlando Fiore, studied at AMLA, and a lot of the brothers who played congas, played drums specifically in Philly. So I just kind of immersed myself into that culture, played in African dance. As my daughter grew, she started going to African dance classes. So I started playing with the dance classes with Jan Jeffries. So I played with the dance classes, and then I played at church with the children's choir, kind of evolved and played at church, and then I got a gig with Platinum Grill in Chester Hill, and I started promoting my event there, and I did that for about 2 years. So that kind of taught me about promoting. Writer for myself. I worked with Kenny Gates, Sam Reed, Kendra Butler. So I did that for a couple of years, and that really taught me the business. I said, let me see if I can just do promotion. So I've been kind of been like a home-based business for me, like a hobby.
Okay.
But I play at church every Sunday, in a Baptist church. I play every Sunday, and, when I work around the city, I play with a lot of great musicians, and I see it, Dickerson, Sam Reed, Yase Ali. I play just a lot of folks in Philly. So it's been fun. It's been a blessing. These drums have been a blessing to my life.
Joe, you talk about the young man that's performing on Saturday, Yase Ali. He's a young gentleman. How difficult is it now to keep the spirit of jazz alive with our young people and learning to play instruments. You know, with the advent of a lot of synthesized music now, a lot of young people, and if they're into hip hop and all, they're not playing instruments. They might be doing a turntable if they're still doing that, or just using their voice synthesized, but it's no mute. The music is artificially created, but it's always a treasure when anybody learns to play an instrument. How difficult is it to keep the spirit of jazz and even playing instruments alive among young people? Or is it that hard? Because you don't see a lot of people doing it, but I know that you're in music, so you see a lot of our young people playing.
Well, exactly. So a lot of times, because actually, I say he's on the phone now calling me. A lot of times, because we're not controlling our image, it's my theory, so we don't really see. There are a lot of people playing, and a lot of times, and you know who's playing? These guys are playing in the church. These young brothers, it's a couple guys. Trey Lampert, drummer at church, Justin Faulkner, phenomenal. These guys playing in church, and they playing on all these pop gigs. So a lot of guys are coming up playing the music that way. So there's another brother had an event over the holidays, over Thanksgiving. I think his name is Little John Roberts, the drummer. They have an event over Thanksgiving. They go in, and it's out West Philly at the church. And it's filled with young people. They have a big drum off and everything. God come from New York. God come from down south. It's a big drum off and everything. And all these church musicians, and these guys are playing the music. They're playing, like I said, it's black music. So they're playing what they know. And they're good. It may not be traditional jazz. It may not be what you would think, but they're phenomenal musicians. There's a lot of young phenomenal musicians out here, and that's why you see some of the growth, the kids who are playing in the church. Also, you cannot, a lot of white kids are playing the music, and they're getting it through school. So if you're going to a certain public, like sad to say, if you're in like a suburban area, a lot of they have good music programs that you can come up through the music programs and take lessons and everything, and you become you can become a decent musician. So it's a lot of young guys of all races playing the music. A lot of times they're getting it through the college too, through school. They're not getting it, I'll say, organically, you know. So that's what I see.
Well, you know, because I want to. Kind of going through a little background, but before you, I want to follow up on something you mentioned, because you go into a lot of these suburban schools and they still have music programs there, and the young people are learning to play instruments and music enrichment or classes, period. But in the Philadelphia public schools, you don't have those programs anymore. They've taken these things away. So it's really hard for our young people to really grow up learning to play instruments. I mean, when I was going to elementary school, I played the violin and the trombone. I didn't stick with it, but I played it. The classes were there. But those classes don't exist anymore for our young people, so it's difficult for our young people to really get into it unless the parents kind of steer their children into playing an instrument, or unless a child is musically inclined. That talent is there among a lot of our young people, and I guess you see it a lot.
I was a children's choir director, okay? And when I first did it, because I had a little bit of music ability, I had no more than anybody else. And I did that, I think, about 8-9 years at my church. It was phenomenal, the talent. And each one of the kids. So many of my kids, they're all very, very, very gifted. They get messed up when they get out into the world.
Okay.
So I didn't want anybody coming in under 5 years old. And then it's Mr. Joe, you know, Bookie wants to come, and she's 3 and a half. I said, well, there can't be no diapers. Man, 3-year-olds come in. By the time they get to 4, they're hitting it. They're hitting the notes right.
Wow. You start them that early?
Yeah, well, I didn't want to start it early. The parents, you know, they want a little Pookie in on the choir. You know, so when you give it to them, they catch it. That was the biggest surprise to me when I started working with them at the kids with the choir. How talented, how naturally talented our kids were through the years. It'd be like one group will come through, and then the next group will come through, and each group was like, "Oh, this guy's a star. This guy, or this girl has talent." They're picking things up, musical talent.
Okay.
So most of our kids, it's like they actually have a gift. It was. I'm gonna say over 90% of them had something.
Okay.
Maybe this came to Baptist Church, but the kids has. But I don't believe that. If the kids had something, it was almost surprising. Even some of the. We have diverse folks. Some of the folks' backgrounds, the kids' parents' backgrounds were kind of, they had some challenges.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And they're looking at, ooh, but the child was good.
Okay.
Flat out good. You know, so we are very, 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 very talented people. We're gifted people. It's just we just have to use our talent and get it directed. So we kind of look, I think, as a community and as a country, but we have to take our future more seriously. I see if these kids had the same opportunity that some of the kids in the suburban schools had, it would be a different story. They start to, in our little district, I mean, I'm right outside Philly, I mean, they start in the second, third grade. They have great music teachers. The jazz band instructor is phenomenal. And then I go to these jazz band competitions with my daughter. And it would be predominantly white, with the exception of Camden. So Camden was always the best. Camden Performing Arts.
Okay.
They were heads and shoulders above everybody. But they were a performing arts school, but they were generally all black. But most of the bands, I only had like maybe three or four, two black kids in them. And they were the kids. Didn't matter. The kids were playing music. The kids were good. Well, Marion, I'm having a great program out there. The kids were playing. Now you can't got to give it to them, and it takes work to play the music. But it's just sad that some of these inner city kids don't have the same opportunity. It's like two different worlds. And if we had the same opportunity that they have out here, they would be taking it to another level too. Because I can see that I can see how my daughter grew up in the culture and how she was kind of ahead. Like. Being in dance and so when it came down and they played Weather Report, the song. Oh, she had danced Weather Report, so she knew the song. But it's her culture that she's playing. She had to feel for it because she grew up with me. You know what I mean? So half the songs she started playing, she knew. Or knew the feel of them. And just so they teach you how to read and everything. So, but yeah, we have to just work on it. So there are a lot of kids who are playing music. It's just that we just got to maybe get a little bit organized.
Joe, let's go into a little of the history of jazz. According to several sources, and I want you to kind of fill in the blanks, it's alleged that jazz started in New Orleans around the turn of around early 1900s, late 1800s, that it started in New Orleans. I mean, if you're talking about jazz or blues, but if you look at any musical forms that are in this country, whether you're talking about later on hip-hop and rap, R&B definitely, rock and roll, spirituals which evolved into gospel, jazz, big band, all of those art forms basically came from us. They credit us basically with jazz and blues. But talk about the origin of jazz. Did it start, according to different reports, in New Orleans? Or because we were in other cities before New Orleans. So to me, it would seem that it would kind of sprang up in different spots. But talk about the origin as you know it.
Well, again, I'm not a scholar, you know, but I to your point, like you got Congo Square was designated, I think, in like 1817 by New Orleans City Council as an official site for slave dances, and that's in New Orleans. So from my research is like from 1786 until like 1855. hundreds of slaves gathered on a weekly basis for song and dance, you know, in an atmosphere that mimicked the West African marketplace. And that's kind of what I'm kind of trying to create here. So that's kind of the history. But similar scenarios played out throughout, you know, the United States. We had a Congo Square in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. you know, and in New York.
Okay.
So when you, as someone who's traveled around, you know, I've been in the country. I've seen genius in the country play. I've seen it in Chicago. But the closest I ever came to getting happy was in a nightclub at the Cotton Club in Chicago. This woman was singing the blues. This little woman was breathtaking. So people play the music all over. I mean, you got it. So that's my theory, including the Caribbean, mm-hmm. you know. So, this start there, and then, it went up the river to New Orleans. That's from New Orleans up the Mississippi River, you know, to St. Louis. And that was and that's where the musicians worked and played on those river boats. So it went up the river to Chicago and then came east. That's kind of the theory that they say, but we got to look at all the great musicians that were born in North Carolina. You know, John Coltrane, Thelonious Monk, Dizzy Gillespie. It's Philadelphia, all the great ones that were born here.
Mm-hmm.
So they're wherever we are, Texas has a great tradition. So, you know, wherever we are, we're creating, as the African spirit, in my opinion, it's still alive, and the music is being produced. And Cuba, they're complete musicians down there. And, you know, phenomenal musicians coming out of Cuba. Mongo. And as a percussionist, you study the rhythms, and what you see is the interconnectedness between all the genres, like you said. So you see the interconnectedness between the Afro-Cuban rhythms and how it can go with the blues, how it can go with especially the contemporary gospel music that I play at church, you know, how it goes with jazz. And I had heard a guy say, like, samba is really like a funk beat. When you learn the rhythm, the samba, Brazilian samba,
mm-hmm.
and the funk is really kind of like the same rhythm, the same feel. I would call it, like my teacher Umar Johnson, Omar Hill used to talk about, listen to James Brown, listen to James Brown. I mean, even, you know, playing jazz, he played jazz. But listen to James Brown, listen to what the guy did with all the Motown, with that Marvin Gaye, what's going on. Goom, goom, bop, goom, 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 bop, that feel, you know, is very similar to a Brazilian samba. So when you study the rhythms, you can start to see the interconnectedness through the Caribbean, through West Africa, through what... to Brazil and to the United States. So you see that we're really, really one people. They try to separate us through the rhythms, and that's what I'm talking. That's still alive. That's kind of like that strain. That's what I'm trying to put in my concert. You know, we're still here, and those rhythms are still here. Babatunde Olatunde, his groundbreaking album with the African rhythms. In fact, it came out like in the 60s, and I played it for a guy. I said, well, that's a Brazilian tune. Well, that's Bob and Tunney did it. That was a West African tune. Well, that's Brazilian rhythm. Yeah, so we're all in. We all connected. It's absolutely had roots in New Orleans. But the black folks, it was like they wasn't playing music in Philly.
Okay.
Or New York, you know what I mean? So that's my take on it.
Brother Richard?
I know that we, and I appreciate the work you're doing, Brother Joe, and pulling this together and helping to keep the tradition of jazz using, Jazz Celebration Month, because it is, you know, as it's being told by, you know, in a broader community, jazz is truly the American classical music. And as you imply, you know, until we embrace it and actually support it, then we won't actually see the value that it brings. But it seems that Jelly Roll Morton was the one that the pianist that in New Orleans that was the one that actually started the fast pace of syncopation of which became, which from what I understand, the term, it wasn't the term jazz wasn't their first term. It was ass was the first term that later turned into jazz. But something you said, Brother Joe, that I wanted to, you know, in being able to educate us all on, you know, before the birth of your child, you were attending these clubs. So it'd be interesting, what clubs at the time you were going to hear the music and dance in the music, and that was the as y'all mentioned about the syncopation, the rhythm, the beat, the movement, you know, that continues to be able to inspire African people and people around the world. What were the clubs in Philly that you went to hear this music and do that dance?
I'm 56, so I mean, all in high school, I went to Wagner's Ballroom, Impulse, Kim Graves. I'm a regular, you know, clubs that we went to growing up. I used to sneak into, I'm from my area, I used to sneak into Charlie P's on Friday. Also, I would get church on Sunday. That's a really big influence. And that's what a lot of top musicians play in church every Sunday because of the steady work. So the 20 grand in Tuskegee, you know, when I went away to college, at graduate school at Penn State, whenever there was, I used to like to dance. Wherever there was dancing, and the club that was happening about, like a fun one we used to go to was the Ebony Lounge in Camden. That was fun. That way we were like teenagers, and you know, the drinking was, I just want to tell everybody, it was 18. Not that we were drinking, but we could get in there. we can get in the Ebony Lounge on Broadway. And he like the whole neighborhood, all Mount Airy was there. The whole neighborhood would go over to Camden, and that was a big club, and because it was 18. So that was a fun place. But yeah, I spent, my friend who's a jazz promoter now, Jim Tucker, used to have clubs when club parties at Holy Cross Church. And that was, he said, Jason, you raise the funds, use the money for choir ropes at Holy Cross in Mount Airy. So we used to go through high school, we used to dance there. You know, every weekend it was a place, coming up through high school, places in, used to be in the mall, in the Cheltenham Mall, used to be one. So, yeah, whatever there was, music. When it was positive, it was the funk, you know, funky, fun stuff like James Brown, you know, the funk. My sister and family, we would go there, whether it was in the house. You know, we have house parties and, you know, and basement parties. Every weekend, somebody was having something, so we were always looking forward to that. So that's kind of the culture that I grew up in, going out dancing. So I used to come home and look in the mirror and practice, because back then, you know, you're a good dancer, you know, girls look at you and so forth and so on. So I used to enjoy that. I still do. I don't move as easy as I did back then.
Yeah. Hey, we all don't. But you know, it's I understand that the Clef Club, you know, still is developing, you know, is another venue besides the church that develops musicians, young musicians, in order, you know, they have different.
Oh yes,
people coming
out of the Clef Club. Yeah.
That's a venue where jazz is really still cultivated in Philadelphia.
Absolutely. I produced two shows at the Clef Club. Yeah, two great shows at the Clef Club. Actually, the first one I did was with Yase Ali. I called it the Philly Jazz Future. So, yeah, Yase is on the gig tomorrow. He's from the Clef Club. And they've been and they're being a big support. And I'll say, in Philly scene, generally everybody kind of supports one another, and everybody knows one another. Yeah, Mr. Hines, Mr. Gardner, they supported me on this gig, and I produced a show there with Yase and Emmanuel Wilkins, when he went to, got to go to Juilliard, another young, phenomenal kid out of Ron Williams, he's from Shelham, he's at George Washington College, forgot his name, piano player. But yes, they do a great job. And I've been out producing show there with Tia Fuller, there. Yeah. So Oklahoma is a great place.
Another thing, Ellie, you know, we can, there was just a movie came out about, Lee Morgan,
and dealing with, Colin Morgan, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah, who is a Philadelphian, trumpet player.
Trumpet player, yes, yes. Stan Reed came along with Lee Morgan, who's on the gig tomorrow, and they grew up together, yes, Lee.
Which I was surprised to see, you know, the richness, because the celebration of Ali Morgan was 15 years old when he went and was playing with, you know, went up to play with Dizzy. And it seems that they were, you know, in that West Philadelphia area, it was a lot of musicians that were congregating. And as you said, kind of experimenting, kind of was more organic at the time. So,
yes, it was part of the culture, yes. And all the neighborhoods. You have McCoy out of West Philly, you know, Doc Gibbs was out there, you know. South Philly was, you know, Stan Reed, the Heath Brothers, Sonny Fortune, I think he's from North Philly, and John Coltrane lived in North Philly. Mm-hmm. You know, Dizzy Gillespie, who lived in South Philly, you know, so... all the neighborhoods, Meyer Lancaster, up in Germantown, and a lot of folks from up my way. So, yes, the whole, each neighborhood produced a lot of great talent.
You know, Joe, we're in conversation this evening with percussionist Joe Harrison. He's producing the Jazz Appreciation Month show this Saturday at Canaan Baptist Church, 12 noon to 4 p.m., at 5430 Pulaski Avenue, honoring the legendary saxophonist Mr. Sam Reed with vocals with Suzanne Burgess and young phenom Yusuf Ali and his friends. Joe, if you look at the history of our folks and some of our ancestors that played jazz that are gone now, in the 40s and 50s, jazz kind of changed to like a bebop. It changed again if you're talking about in the 70s and 80s with Grover Washington and others. But let's look back at that era during the 40s and 50s when you had Charlie Parker and Thelonious Monk and others that were playing jazz. But you've seen, and even some of the women like Billie Holiday and all that went from jazz to blues, you know, kind of back and forth. You see the introduction of heavy drugs, and not all of them did it, but some of them did it, and it took them down and away from here, and others did it, and they kind of recovered from it, maybe like Miles Davis and others. But talk about the introduction of drugs into jazz music, and because a lot of our folks back then didn't have black management. To get in a lot of these venues, they had to have white promoters and managers. Do you think that kind of correlated with the introduction of heroin and other drugs to a lot of these performers?
Well, I'm not the expert on everything. I have an opinion on everything.
Go ahead.
But I'm not an expert. I was at a lecture up at Borders years ago with Donald Byrd, the trumpet player, the great Donald Byrd, played with everybody, phenomenal trumpet player. And he went from that era to really some funky stuff. But anyway, he said it was just plain stupid that these guys got on drugs. He said it didn't make any sense. He was like, where would John Coltrane be today if he hadn't have been on drugs? And he was kind of hard on it.
Okay.
He said, why? He was down, and this was right up in Chestnut Hill. And it was a lecture. He had a book out. And he said, it was just dumb. And why would you do that? Now, Randy West's book, his theory was that in that time, the course of pop acts, and that was, they were pop acts. They were the main acts, the leading acts, and they were influential. And Randy Weston, in his book, this is a great book. He said in Brooklyn that somebody was, they were, women were coming around that were kind of offering to the musicians. That's what he said. Now, that's what's in this book. But it wasn't, I don't know whose fault it was, but it did not need to happen. I mean, the guys had bad problems. So did Jack Coltrane. That's why they all died young.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? That's like, so, he kind of have, I don't know, a little bit different type of fiber, moral fiber, so a little bit more a different focus, you know. And a lot of times you got to realize the times. It was depressing times because if you're already a big star and you're treated like crap. So it's just like now people may try to mask. And this is just Joe's theory. This is not based on nobody's reality. But even today, people try to mask or hide how they really feel through television, through drinking, through just getting high, and all kind of things. So to get back to the purpose of this music is a spiritual thing. And that's why I like doing it at church, because this is a spiritual thing. This is a gift from God to play this music.
Okay.
So you got to kind of look at your purpose. Why are you doing this? Are you doing it for fame and fortune, or are you doing this as a gift from God? And you trying to this music is can be transformational, and it can heal people. It can make people feel better. So when I see you play the song, it's like, oh, if people will start to move, and music is a healing force. So in that vein, I think you kind of should focus on it. But people, you know, I don't know. So when you get out there playing, at the end of the day, sometimes you're still high and you still need to do something else. I don't know. I don't know.
I have to remember that the whole advent of the music, of the form, as far as dealing with the African American, it comes out of that club experience, comes out of really, from poet prohibition. Through.
Yeah,
I mean it's a grueling to be a performer, to be an artist. It seemed to be a grueling experience when you're trying to always and I guess that's an artist or athlete. You're always trying to get better, and you're always trying to go one step beyond. And you're in an environment where they're giving you, where it's accessible. Something is accessible to try to assist you, and you become dependent on whether it's your moral fiber or your stamina or your aspirations. You become susceptible. That's, you know, again, that would be my opinion. Because a lot of even when we talk about athletes and we're talking about what's these things that they get injected with in order to try to
steroids.
Steroids, mm-hmm. You know, it's the aspiration of wanting to be able to go. But when we're talking about this, the environment and the experience, I mean, when you say about during the 40s and 50s, when you had these segregated clubs and that pressure on these artists who really had, from what I can see, had a lot high aspirations of themselves, you know, they were artists. They knew what they could do, but they were also all constantly learning and young. So
they were young.
So you can easily get caught up into something and get chemicalized. I think that's important. The two points of the history of especially jazz. Cases, we didn't own a lot of those places we played in.
Yeah, but I don't want to stop you there. Well, just please don't make it sound like it was the drug use was connected to jazz only.
That's why
rock and roll guys that live a rough life too, and I played with some of my friends, so they're doing if that is not more. What I'm finding today is a lot of the guys, the young guys, are clean cut, kind of. You know, they're educated. They're coming out of school, and they kind of they're not like those street guys. A lot of the young guys I know who play like kind of middle class with good families. You know,
would you say, Joe, that because there's one thing that, and I know schools like Berkeley and whatever, they have created, as you had mentioned earlier, created a whole jazz curriculum and jazz program. So college students are able to take jazz as a major course in order to develop. But it seems to me, and I don't know, you know, as you say, you know, from studying anything, but the jazz musicians of earlier, some were skilled musicians, say Miles Davis, who went to Juilliard, right? But they rehearsed and rehearsed and rehearsed. They were trying to create something, and as you made the reference, Elliot, you know, even to go from swing kind of jazz to bebop, that was a transition in their experimentation with the music. And I think Coltrane moved even to another level when he went into meditation, as far as trying to take the music. Coltrane and other jazz musicians were trying to get to the essence of music, utilizing the format of jazz, and the format being where you're in a band, but you can take those individual solos. You're in a group, and this is where I see the African tradition is. You're in a group, but the group allows you to go off as an individual with your instrument, and then still be able to come back and be with a group. So you can be the individual and the group at the same time.
If you play in an African drumming and drumming tradition, it's called the speaking part. So everybody holds it down. You may have 3-4 drummers playing a rhythm, and the quinto, which is the loud one, the solo drum, is just the speaking part. So that's the connectedness. So whether he's playing a saxophone, that he's giving his voice, he's being creative, he's doing the speaking part. It's similar to playing drums, playing congas or djembe, where you got the lead drummer, he's playing, which is the speaking part, which was katanga. So you're right, it's that interconnectedness is there from Africa to the music. So you see the similarities, especially, you know, to the rhythms. But back to the, I don't know, it's no... Because you know yourself, you really don't need to be on drugs. I just say it wasn't a good thing. You know what I mean? And Donald Byrd, he was kind of clear. He was like, I bought art, and I went over all over the world, and I got degrees. Okay, he was Dr. Donald Byrd, and then he got degrees from Europe and Canada, and he worked at Howard. He was at Dell State, and he studied. And he bought art with his money, and he said it was stupid. And I'm just that's what he said. I know. I turned to my father. You can't let folks off the hook. I mean, it was a bad scene. You know, it wasn't no good coming out of get on drugs.
Joe,
because that's just his black music, and this is again, the jazz is one thing, but this is really our music. And I look at jazz as a marketing term. So to do this show with Jazz Appreciation Month is marketing, because the city helps you, and then it's like a big deal. So it helps you with the marketing. But what I look at it as is African music that has evolved to a high level, and this is the best this is black excellence that we are producing tomorrow. This is high-level black excellence. Jazz is just a term, but this is what has happened from the transition from West Africa through the Caribbean, through the transatlantic slave trade up until now, and that the spirit is still here, and we'll stay here, and this is excellence. I'm booking this gig. I don't want anybody high tomorrow.
I don't want to be cracked, you know what I mean, I don't want that, I don't want this in my church family, this is like my family, like my wife gonna be there, you know, and kids, and other people's kids, so I don't really want that scene there, you know, I don't want that there, I want black excellence, and black excellence is not shooting up heroin before you get on the stage. You know what I mean?
That's Joe, me. Before we leave this evening, give out the location of the concert, which your work, what you're doing with young people is really, and keeping the music alive with young people is just, you know, because I told you before that I wanted to kind of do some things centering around young people and playing the music. So we'll get together because that's something I still want to do. And
your work
with them is very much appreciated. But give out again the information about the Jazz Appreciation concert tomorrow.
This wonderful celebration takes place April 22nd. That's tomorrow. Doors open at noon. Program starts at 12:30. The first jazz set is from 1 to 2, and then with Yase and friends. He's going to have Wesley Robinson on piano. I think his father was a leasing. I think of Breakwater. Then Rod speaks on bass, and one of my favorite drummers, Kyrie Abdul-Shahid on drums, and Kyrie plays congas, djembe, and drums. And he's a great, great drummer with Sam Reed and this lovely Suzanne Burgess with Sonny Keaton playing that soulful organ of his, Wayne Morgan on the drums, and George Baracus on the guitar. That's at 5430 Pulaski Avenue. Come ready to taste Chef Naomi's food. It's going to be good. I'm looking for that grilled salmon tomorrow. And Kit, again, trying to expose the youth to the music. So that's why I made kids 17 and under free. Because I want the kids just to see some young black males who aren't crazy or saying crazy stuff playing the music.
Okay.
Yeah, that's my goal.
Joe, thank you for your work, man, and I hope everybody go out. The proceeds from the show tomorrow will go towards some of the youth programs at Kingdom Baptist Church.
Portion of proceeds, yes, they will. Thank you.
Joe, I want to thank you for being with us, and we're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll be moving into the second portion of our program with historian Mr. Joe Becton. We'll be talking about the history of black folks in Philadelphia from early on to the present day gentrification going on. We'll talk about the historical significance of all of this from our ancestors to the present with historian Mr. Joe Becton. And we're going to take a brief break, and Mr. Joe Harrison is taking us out on this break. Joe, thanks for being with us, man, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back.
Take care now. Good.
Tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
Not a Wu-China.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Hey, did y'all see the stuff I posted on my wall?
Nah, it didn't even show up in my news feed.
Man, I'm done with social media. All the injustice and brutality going around, and it's like they're trying to suppress our voice. We're trying to get the message out there, and you can't even share empowerment and what's going on around the country either.
Nah, don't be dumb with social media, though. It's a tool, and there is a place where we have a voice. It's a Let's Buy Black 365 social network. You do anything you would on any other social network. Post pictures, videos, status updates, share resources and community news. But on Let's Buy Black 365, it's a platform for us and by us to tell our messages.
Whoa, that's like a digital underground railroad.
What's the name of that site again?
It's letsbuyblack365.com.
Yeah, I heard about that. It's all about networking, and you get points, right?
Yeah, the more you network, post, and share, the more points you get. Plus, you get points for posting pictures, sharing information, attending community events, and inviting others to network with you on the app.
Wow, that's all I need to know. I'm gonna go download that app right now.
Now, better yet, let me invite you so I can get some points. It's all about empowerment and solutions, y'all.
Yeah, that's what's up. I'm all in.
Let's do it. Let's share our stories.
Let's buy Black365.com.
What is in 1 million brothers and sisters who are tired of the same old rhetoric, the same old leaders, the same old ways of dealing with political and economic empowerment? If you realize that nobody's going to save black people but us, if you understand that no existing political party prioritizes the best interests of African Americans as a collective, if you believe that leadership is as leadership does, and this means that the best leaders for the black collective must come from the ranks of those who place and hold the best interests of black people foremost and uttermost, if you understand that black people must develop the mindset and the will to finance their own racial uplift organizational efforts, then get involved with 1 million conscious black voters and contributors. The movement is now. Go to www.iamoneofthemillion.com. That's www.iamoneofthemillion.com.
At the end of last month, Donald Trump unveiled his military budget, obscenely inflated by $54 billion, a 10% increase that will be paid for with cuts to social programs. There was no organized denunciation from the Democrats, and a few days later, when former Kentucky Governor Steve Beshear gave the Democratic Party response to Trump's speech before the Congress, he had not a word of criticism for Trump's military budget, but instead charged that the president was ignoring serious threats to our national security from Russia. Russia, Russia, Russia. It is the great diversion by which the Democrats pretend to lead a resistance to Trumpism, but present no serious opposition to Trump and his fellow Republicans' gutting of poor and working people's programs in the service of militarism. The Democrats are putting up no real fight against Trump's domestic austerity agenda. Like Barack Obama, they would welcome a grand bargain with the Republicans that freezes or shrinks the social side of the budget while continuing to fund multiple wars all over the planet. Indeed, their principal problem with Trump was that he wasn't bellicose enough. They feared that he might not be eager to play nuclear chicken with the Russians. They are implacable in their battle with Trump, the man, but put up only the most pro forma resistance to Trump's people-crushing budget proposals. Do not expect the Democrats to wage an honest fight for the people's health care interests either. The Republican plan to replace Obamacare is, as expected, an unmitigated disaster. While Obamacare was festering in its own contradictions, the Republican replacement will likely result in 10 million more uninsured Americans and total chaos at every level of health care infrastructure, resulting in an almost instantaneous social and medical crisis, and not just for poor people. The Democrats cynically see the impending disaster as an opportunity to position themselves for the 2018 and 2020 elections. Although Obamacare is dead and cannot be resurrected, they will make a show of defending its various parts, one doomed element at a time, even as the private insurance markets that are available to lower-income people disintegrate. The Democrats will be glad to let the crisis fester under Republican corruption and incompetence, and then, as the next election season opens, propose some reworked version of Obamacare, probably with weak provisions for a public option. What they will not do, as a party, is respond to the crisis with a push for single-payer Medicare for all, a solution the party's corporate masters will not tolerate. Bernie Sanders himself has said that he has no plans to submit his own Medicare for all bill to the Senate this year, part of his accommodation with the Obama-Clinton party bosses. But that's fine. The demand should come from masses of people in the streets, representing the supermajorities that have favored single-payer for decades. This is a movement moment, and progressive activists must seize the time. The Democrats, however, anticipated that the left might take the initiative at this critical point in history, which is why they created the Great Russian Diversion, to distract silly minds. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. I want to thank percussionist and producer Mr. Joe Harrison for joining us in the first portion of the program. Again, his program, Honoring Jazz Appreciation Month, is a celebration of the legendary saxophonist Mr. Sam Reed at Canaan Baptist Church, which is Saturday, April 22nd, 12 noon to 4 p.m., 5430 Pulaski Avenue in Philadelphia. My Blue Heaven is the food vendor there. It's an African marketplace starting a little before 12. The admission, again, is $20. Children 17 and under is absolutely free. Go out and see the performances of the young people with Yusef Ali and friends, and honor legendary saxophonist Mr. Sam Reed, and say hello to Brother Joe Harrison while you're there. We're moving into the second portion of our program, and we're talking about Black Philadelphia, looking at some of our ancestors that have made an impact in this city, and realizing that Philadelphia is one of the oldest cities in this country, and our people have made it just as much of an impact as Europeans have in the city of Philadelphia. After arriving in Philadelphia in the early 1700s as chattel slaves on Delaware Avenue at the slave markets that was down there, we'll talk about these things and leading up to the present day gentrification going on in a lot of major cities, Philadelphia in particular, we'll be talking about with the historian. Mr. Joe Becton is with us on the line. Mr. Becton, how are you, sir?
I'm doing very well. Doing very well. Glad to be on the show this evening.
We're glad to have you. And Mr. Becton, give our listening audience a little brief bio of yourself. What I know about you is you're Brother Richard's mentor. You taught him everything he knows about being a tour guide.
I wasn't going to say it, but I'm going to put it out there.
When he gave me a test, I failed. But I kept going, and he kept encouraging me.
Well, yes, myself and Richard, we've worked together on many, many projects, training at the African American Museum, giving different Afrocentric tours around the city and doing research together. So, yes, I would like to say we're great friends.
Okay.
Me personally, I'm born right here in West Philly. Went away, you know, to be in the Marines, you know, so I could get ready for college, pay for my education and all that kind of stuff. So after I turned from the Marines, went to Reading Area Community College. That was kind of a good thing for me. I was a high school dropout out of Overbrook. So then when I got over there to Reading Area Community College after the Marines, I had a little bit different attitude and managed to get through the junior college at Reading, a couple of associate degrees, and went on down to Florida, to the University of West Florida, where I got my history and education degree and published my very first articles on the Negro Fort on the Apalachicola. You know, Africans who had escaped from the American lands into the Spanish lands, literally constructed forts at places like called St. Simon and the Negro Fort, Fort Musa.
Okay.
And, of course, put up a resistance in that area from Florida into the United States and made a special space where Africans could go and be free. So, of course, that's one of the stories that we, as Americans, don't really discuss, but it's one of the great ones about the Seminole Indians and the Seminole Wars. So my first publications were right there in Florida on those kinds of subjects. One of them was called The Exodus to Freedom, where the entire population, black population of Pensacola, left town at one time with the British so that they can be free escaping the Spanish. So, as I said, that's kind of where I get started. I was started down there in Florida as a park ranger with the National Park Service. I eventually moved up here to Pennsylvania, got a job as a Valley Forge, and then at the Broken Bell while I was at Valley Forge, along with Dr. Blocks. And, of course, we did research on identifying the Africans at the Valley Forge encampment.
Okay.
And I came the Delta Sigma Theta, Delta Monument and Memorial up there. I guess it was way back in 91, you know, so based on the 287 people that we identified, we were able to have that monument constructed there. Later on, of course, I moved downtown to be, a Broken Bell guy hanging around the Liberty Bell. And I had the opportunity to work on a couple of exhibits there. Two of them that still stand. One in the Military Museum on the second floor, Africans in the American Revolution, and one in the main Liberty Bell chamber about Reconstruction. Myself and a guy named Dwight McCaffley from the University of New Mexico worked on those stands where we have Fred Douglas, we have Little Bear from the Blackfeet Indian, we have Jefferson Davis from the President of the Confederacy. So it's kind of this juxtaposition as to what happened when the Civil War was over and, once again, how we ultimately lost out in the Reconstruction. So those are the kinds of things I've been doing up here in Pennsylvania. I started a reenactment group, the 3rd Regiment United States Colored Troop Civil War Reenactors. So anytime you see black Civil War reenactors, you know that that is our group.
Okay.
We've got a brother group up in Trenton, the 6th USCT, and we also created a group called the 1st Rhode Island. So those things have been going on for about 10 years. 1st Rhode Island is an American Revolutionary War group. And, of course, in the Philadelphia area, you can always catch us at the Battle of Germantown or the Battle of Red Bank over there in Fort Mercer, New Jersey. So we're always out there trying to tell those stories of our ancestors, stories that have never been told. You know, the rumors that we hear every day at 6 about us being murderers, criminals, drug dealers, all those kinds of interesting lies to convince us not to be who we really are, the heroes and the stewards of freedom. Right now I'm working on a special project out here in West Philly with the Islamic Center and the New Freedom District, where we're starting to try to train young people to give tours, do historic impressions up and down Lancaster Avenue, ultimately to move to Baltimore Avenue and even over to the Centennial Fairgrounds. So this is our second year at that, and we're hoping that some young people will want to come and join us. They're at 4243 at the New Freedom Center, so we're going to be getting that going June 1st to begin that training. So there's always something going on. But maybe we should start at the start when it comes to Philadelphia.
Mr. Beckman, and then that's what we're going to do. I want to touch on some things and kind of dot back and forth in history and kind of lead up to the present. I know Brother Richard wants to add some things in there. But let me start here because You know, I talked briefly about the arrival of our ancestors here in the city of what we know as Philadelphia at that time, as chattel slaves. I think according to some reports, Philadelphia wrote their first emancipation of our ancestors in 1780. But up until that point, it was slavery going on in the North and South. We've had Dr. Boxen on the program on several occasions when he was working on some of our ancestors that was at that president's house when they put that monument down there on the 6th and Market. But talk a little bit about Oney Judge and Hercules that escaped from the president's house. A lot of those individuals we don't know. And me personally, when I look at some of my ancestors in history, I try to or talk to somebody that wrote about them or know something about them. I try to get a little feel for them as a person and kind of close my eyes and kind of imagine what they were going through and who they were. Tell us a little bit about what you know about Oney Judge and Hercules at the president's house.
Well, you know now, Mrs. Dunbar, Dr. Dunbar, has just recently put out a wonderful book, a monograph on Oney Judge, right? So we do have a few little bit of information about her, some of it which comes from her own mouth. She was interviewed in New Hampshire. She must have been up in years, maybe 50. And they went to interview her, and they said, well, why didn't you go back with George? I said, well, no, I really didn't need to go back with George. I was away from George. At one point, George Washington said, well, if you come back, you come back, and I will. And, of course, she knew what he meant. You come back, and I will beat you with a whip for running away.
Okay.
And her whole thing was like, well, no, I don't need to come back to get your permission because I'm already gone. In Miss Dunbar's book, she talks a lot about the way we use that name, Oney, Ona. Well, not a lot, but she mentions it. And she mentions that it's an insult, the way that we use it. And I have to agree with her. But, you know, at that time, many of the names that were assigned to us were insulting names.
Okay.
King, Prince, Cato, Boston, London. You know, these are dog names, you know.
Okay.
And I have to agree with 100% when you call her Oney, you're using like a dog name rather than Ona,
okay.
Which is more the formal Irish name. So that's just one of the many points that she brings out in her book. She does a very, once again, good book about Ona. Now, Hercules seems like he has this special opportunities and personality. What happened was Washington, when he was in New York, he had Irish women cooking for him, and he decided he really didn't like what they were doing. So he let them go before he moved to Philadelphia. He moved to Philadelphia, and he got them to bring Hercules out of Virginia so he could be the cook in Philadelphia. Some rumors about, you know, him having special access to food and being able to sell food later if it was left around. Definitely the stories about him, you know, going out into the streets with his basically nice attire. I guess that's the whole thing, you know. If you work for the Washingtons, you know, you live in the best house, you have the best attire, you have the best food after they get finished with it. And so I guess that's what it was. He was out almost immediately after dinner was served. He was out walking around letting people see him. Everybody knew that he was Hercules and enslaved by Washington, but they also knew that he had special opportunities. The best thing for him, though, was, I guess, that he escaped.
Mm-hmm.
So when they heard that he was going to go back to Virginia, and there's a lot of confusion about whether he actually made it back to Virginia, and they put him out in the instead of making him a house person, or really never made it back to Virginia when he left Philadelphia. And, of course, I guess that's the way you have to do it when you're going to go. Nobody never knows when you're going to go.
You know, that's one of the questions I wanted to ask you, is do they know where they had escaped to? And you mentioned that Ona was found in New Hampshire later on.
Yes.
And you said the Hercules tried to go back to Virginia?
The thing was, the presidency was over. The whole family was moving back to Virginia.
Okay.
Yeah. So, no, it wasn't so much that I think that he wanted to go to Virginia. It was time for everybody to go back to Virginia.
Oh, and that's when he escaped, is what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. All right. But it's no details on where he escaped to.
No, as a matter of fact, we have this interesting portrait that we have on display. The Pennsylvania Historical Society used it a couple of years on the cover. Historical Society of Pennsylvania, excuse me, used it a couple of years ago on the cover of their journal, and we have it on an exhibit inside the Liberty Bell. So it's an image of a chef with a 19th century chef's cap on. The caption says that they believe it was made, he'll come to me, the guy that did George Washington's famous portrait, Gilbert Stuart. They believe that it was painted by Gilbert Stuart, and it was found in Madrid, Spain. So when they decided they were going to put that up, there's one of the historians from California, a guy named Gary Nash. And I said, Gary, tell them don't put that up. I said, yeah, I'm the only black guy here. You're going to put that up? Everybody in the world's going to say, Joe Beck didn't put that up there. I don't even like it. I don't think it's him.
Okay.
We don't know who painted it. We think Gilbert Stuart painted it. The guy was in Madrid. How did he get from Virginia to Madrid? And he's wearing clothes, which should be from about 50, 60 years later. Okay. So I disagree with that portrait. But it's there, and people are still saying, attributed to and believed to be Washington's Hercules.
Okay.
But you know what, Joe? I was doing a tour in the museum, and a couple came in with their child, and they had just came back and on a European tour, and it's an African-American couple, and they were in Spain. And they said when they'd seen the you know, because in the exhibit they have a kind of portrait, that portrait. And when they seen it, they said, oh, we seen this in Spain. And they were from New York.
Right,
so,
right.
It's interesting, with, you know, as you're saying, what you're saying, that they have it in a museum in Spain, saying that it's Hercules, who was George Washington's chef.
Wow!
So, you know, they were shocked, and when they told me, I was like, oh yeah, that's the first time, you know, I heard it, and I've heard you mention before about the, you know, the questioning it. So
yeah.
for Spain to have it in their museum also, and you've always said, you know, the question of how, because there's still no real record of how he did escape, if I'm not mistaken.
Nope, not yet.
Mr. Beckton, moving forward.
Let's go back a little bit.
Go ahead.
And about the initial arrival. So when we get here, we started to get here in large numbers here in Philadelphia, large numbers, 1684.
Okay.
Arrive on a ship, 150 Africans arrive. And, of course, once again, this is the Dutch who were involved with this once again. So we get off the ship, they start this sail right now. There's about 1,000 people here, the Dutch, the Swedes, the English, and the Finns are the main Europeans who are around. The Quakers are just getting here. The Quakers, of course, are supposed to be for peace and love. The inner light of God is in every man. Everybody goes crazy buying Africans. Right? Within a few months, all the Africans are sold. So this is the first group. Now, what we have in the 1600s is a big problem. We're not sure who's going to be slaves for life and who's going to be indentured. Right? So in the 1600s, this is very, very, very foggy. Very, very foggy. And it stays that way up until 1700. Now, 1700, 1701, William Penn writes our Charter of Privileges, and with our Charter of Privileges, it becomes like a line that the people who are black, you know, should probably be slaves, and the people who are not black should probably be free. So this is the beginning, of course, of our struggle, because our whole story in America is our defining what freedom is. You know? Because when they came across, freedom was like a word. It didn't really mean anything. They were fighting for liberty when they wanted to be independent,
mm-hmm.
but they weren't fighting for freedom. Of course, freedom would mean that the people who grow the sugar would be free. Freedom would mean the people who grow the tobacco would be free. Freedom would mean the people who dig the gold would be free. So they're not really looking for freedom. We're the ones who begin to define it in the courts, in the fields, on the battlefields, and the schoolhouses everywhere. So those early folks right there, we believe that there's a guy in that first group named Fortune, and that Fortune is probably James Fortin's grandfather.
Okay.
He makes himself free. His Thomas is born free,
And James Fortin, of course, is born free. So from the beginning, there are people in Philadelphia who would be basically, well, I guess we have to call it legally free, because socially they're not free. They can't join the various things. They can't be vestry in the churches, even though they pay their tithes. So it's kind of a, I guess, let's say freedom in name, but not in society. And, of course, that's what pushes everybody to create their own society, you know, with their own churches, their own fraternal organizations, their own schools. So slowly but surely these things begin to develop. I'd like to mention one more guy, too, a guy named Antonio. Antonio was here in the Delaware Valley in 1644, and he was associated with the governor Prince, that's the Swedish governor, P-R-I-N-T-Z, and they were down on Tenicum Island. So sometimes people talk to me and they get a little bit irritated with me. They say, well, Joe, if you don't like what's going on around here, why don't you go back where you came from? And I always like to mention to them, well, I said, well, you know, in this particular area, my relatives have been here since 1644. And, of course, when did your relatives arrive?
Okay, so, wow. Okay. Okay, Mr. Becton. The Absalon Jones and Richard Allen. Now, I know that they were more than ministers or pastors of churches at that time. They were leaders in the community. Talk a little about them, because they were contemporaries. They were here around the same period. So, go ahead.
Let's start with the propaganda, and then we'll get back to the truth.
Good.
All right. Propaganda is Richard Allen, Absalom Jones, and the colored people helped save the white community during the yellow fever epidemic of 1793. Philadelphia loves that story. I mean, yes, they were the heroes. They were great. Well, of course, then there was that little backslide in that Matthew Carey guy, because he went to stab everybody in the back, said, well, actually, the blacks were robbing the sick and stealing from the poor and throwing the dead people out in the street. And so there was that angle of propaganda that was going against them, and then the angle of propaganda that was going, if you will, for them. Now, at the time, Richard Allen and Absalom Jones were good friends. They had been working together. They had just recently, I'm going to say 4 years ago, they walked out of St. George's Methodist Church. So St. George's Methodist is at 4th and Vine, something like that. When they came to America, everybody loved the camp meetings, right? Camp meetings was everything. Everybody went out, you went to the camp meeting, you sang, you made a joyful noise to the Lord. You had wonderful food. You saw people from the community. Blacks and whites. It seemed to be okay. Baptists, Methodists had their outside meetings. Things seemed to go okay. The Baptists finally decided, actually it was the Methodists first who finally decided they're going to move inside. They're going to have a building. And you go, of course, you know, African people, yeah, we like buildings. We're in with that. So we put in our money, paid our tithe, helped build the building. And then after a few years, they decided they're going to change the seating arrangement. Now, I don't know if you go to church or you have ever gone to church, but my grandmother went to the same church ever since she moved to the north. She sat in the same seat for 30 years. That's where she sat. You know, she was a Christian woman, but if you were sitting in a seat, she would mention it to you. Now, here we are, sitting in this and this. They paid their tithes. But Allen is actually on the payroll. They made him a priest to give a sermon at 5 o'clock in the morning. It was getting to be, and this is the theme for Philadelphia and black people, the very beginning. When the 150 people got there, they started saying, oh, no, this is the black people. And they've been saying that since 1684. So here we are in 1787. The church is filling up with black people. They said, we're going to have a 5 o'clock in the morning sermon. All right? The young Richard Allen out of Delaware, he's a firebrand. He get everybody going. They all come at 5 o'clock in the morning, and then we can have the church to ourselves the rest of the day. Of course, what the Methodists don't realize is that Africans go to church all day. They didn't know. They didn't know. So 5 o'clock, we were at the service. 8 o'clock, we were at the service. 11 o'clock, we were at the service. Went home for lunch. We came back for the 3 o'clock service. Don't have a 5 o'clock service because we're going to be there. So They're very, very upset about this. They decided they're going to change the seating arrangement without announcing it. So one morning, the brothers come in. They're down on their knees getting ready to get the morning prayer. Jackson comes and says, "You got to get up. I mean, right now, you got to get up." They're like, "Well, just wait till the end of the prayer." "No, no, no, I'm serious. You got to get up now." He calls in some help. They start grabbing people off their knees during the prayer. I'm like, "Well, when the prayer is complete, then that's when Absalom Jones stands up and says, "Well, you'll be bothered by us no more." So Absalom Jones, Richard Allen, and their friends and associates walked out. Not all of the black people walked out. Some of the black people stayed, and those people who stayed were the ones who actually created the church that we call Zohar. Zohar, we sometimes call it Mother Zohar, with 11 Melon. So they stayed with the Methodists, while Richard Allen and Epsom Jones walked out from the Methodists. Richard Allen ultimately sued the Methodists in 1816 for the right to have his own separate church, because they kept trying to come down the road and collect all the tithe. So he had to take them to Pennsylvania Supreme Court and sue them to create the AME. But here's the trick. Richard Allen created the African Methodist Episcopal, but the regular Methodist is called the American Methodist Episcopal. So it was tricky, it was dicey, but the reason they loved that story, you know, too, is because we were serving the white community. When Richard Allen went on to create his own church, then we had to go to the Supreme Court. As a matter of fact, during that very same era, the guy, the old Say Can You See guy, Sir Francis
Scott Key.
Scott Key.
Mm-hmm.
Francis Scott Key helps to create this organization, the Back to Africa organization. They're called the American Colonization Society. And their whole thing is they want to take all the free blacks and send them back to Africa and leave the other folks ignorant and and enslaved here in America. So that's Say Can You See. You know, a lot of people are complaining about the kids. They don't want to salute the flag. They don't want to sing that song. Look at the third verse of the Star-Spangled Banner.
Mm-hmm.
Third verse of the Star-Spangled Banner tells you about the blacks during the War of 1812 who turned on America because they were not getting no freedom and went to fight with the British, just like many blacks did during the American Revolution. So when they try to tell me about how dumb my kids are, because they're really the dumb ones, see, because that third verse explains it completely, that they didn't even appreciate us in our attempt to get our own freedom because it wasn't in their behalf.
So. And you know what, something, Joe, that we kind of regularly kind of address in the different program and the different people that come in and present to us, is that the different, what you raised, the point of those who stayed in the Methodist Church in spite of, and those who left. And then, you know, those who decided when the American Colonization Society was formed to go, who said they had enough of this compared to those who stayed. I just think it's important that people see that, especially in Philadelphia, that we've had these strains of resistance and accommodationing. All along, as a part of our historical making choices, or as you say, in defining what freedom is. I think that's, you know, important. And can you help flesh that out even more if possible?
Well, yeah, you know, there's the famous guy from Boston, part Indian, part black, Paul Cuffey. So Paul Cuffey had his own ship. And he decided in the 1790s he was going to start taking people back, right? So before the American Colonization Society, there was Paul Cuffey. And Paul Cuffey did come to Philadelphia, and he did meet with Jones and Allen. Of course, don't forget about
what?
The brother who made the Masons, Prince Hall.
Mm-hmm.
Prince Hall also came to Philadelphia and met with those two. So they were very influential, not only in Philadelphia, but up and down the coast. And, of course, ultimately, Richard Allen would move the AME to Haiti, to South America, back to Europe. And, of course, the AME from his little seed is now one of the bigger one of the biggest religious African religious organizations on the planet. So from that, those little seeds right there, that walkout to what they became is quite amazing.
And some of us think that that walkout was planned.
Maybe it was. Maybe it was. I just know that if my grandmother had been sitting there and they came and grabbed her shoulder so that that wasn't her seat no more, it wouldn't have been very Christian.
Well, you taught me something today, Mr. Beckner, because I didn't know that, although I guess you could kind of surmise it, I thought that when Richard Allen and Absalom Jones walked out, that all of our ancestors went with them. I didn't realize that a portion of them stayed. So
yes, they're very proud of that heritage too. There's a man named Harry Hoosier. So Harry Hoosier went without circuit riding with the Methodists. Francis Asbury. So he was all these different places he went with Asbury. One time Asbury tried to get Allen to go to Virginia with him. He said, come on, we're going out here and talk to the people about God. Allen said, nah, you go ahead. I know you will go to Virginia. You'll stay in the tavern. I'll stay in the barn. He said, that's all right. You go ahead. You go ahead, Francis. I'll see you when you get back. But Hoosier, he went anywhere. He went anywhere. You know, so you were a black man. You were out there preaching about the Lord, and you know the crowd doesn't know how to read. You can't show them your freedom papers. They tear up your freedom papers. You know, it's just treacherous. But Harry Hoosier, apparently, he loved this kind of life, and he was the one that they call the founder of their mother's door.
Okay.
So they've got their great tradition, too. You know, by the time we get to the Underground Railroad, Robert Purvis and the Vigilant Committee are operating out of Fourth and Brown out of Mother's Door. So, you know, they've got their history and story. The great thing about Philadelphia is every corner has got its history and story. And as soon as they say that there's nothing African about it, I know there's something African about it. Because they're just tricky like that. They're trying to remake our stories so that we are not there. One of the greatest stories, when the British come to town, 1777, they've got a proclamation from Lord Dunsmore. Lord Dunsmore said, any African who comes to fight for the king against George Washington and the Americans, who's not owned by a loyalist, remember they're tricky too now. Matter of fact, they taught the Americans how to be tricky. So who's not owned by a loyalist will be free. So they come to Philadelphia. Starts a small stampede of people coming to Philadelphia. Dr. Deborah Newman Ham at Morgan State wrote a piece called The Black Women of Colonial Pennsylvania. And in her piece, she talks about 128 families led by women who escaped with the British when they left Philadelphia in 1778. So the so-called Beacon of Freedom, I like to say, was cut on by the British occupation of Philadelphia during the 1770s. And, of course, Philadelphia doesn't pass this Gradual Act of Abolition until 1780. And that Gradual Act is so hollow that we Pennsylvanians don't even celebrate it today. 28 years, somebody got free, and there was no celebration. It was almost like a non-action. Also, the Quakers making a rule in 1775, the Quakers are supposed to get rid of all their slaves, right? So there's a guy named Anthony Benezet who's working inside the Society of Friends. Of course, they pull out of the Pennsylvania government because they refuse to be in a war and fight. And, of course, with their three big problems, the Quakers are pacifists, they believe in educating females, and they believe the Africans should be free. So because of those three things, we have literally written the Quakers out of our history, and Anthony Benezet in particular.
I have to say, Elliot, you know, as you hear Joe now, after he left the Park Service, he formulated his own tour company.
Mm-hmm.
So not only does he do the community service in assisting in developing other tour guides for what he mentioned in West Philadelphia, what he's saying is what he takes people through. Whether they walk, and he's taking us on these 2.5-hour walks, and as he said, every corner, showing you where the people live, where Richard Allen House is, where you can actually see the historical markers. So his company actually takes people through Philadelphia. And it's just a contrast when you see the group of black people walking through the area of Philadelphia now as it's being regentrified or as it's dealing with the, what they call it, the historical district. And then hearing that here is Africans' presence there in that tour, that Joe does it so, you know, thoroughly. And even to people come out of their houses, like, was he showing the historical marker on the house? And they're like wondering, what is these people doing?
Okay.
Yeah, that I've been cussed out. I've been yelled at a couple times. Get away from that house. But you know what? You just happen to move into a historic district. So, but as I said, almost every place has its own special stories, its own, you know, by the time we get back down to Lombard Street, there's Mr. Ball and the Star Gardens and W. Dubois. And, I mean, we've got everything. We've got soldiers. We've got Mrs. Dorothy with the restaurants and insurance funeral home. I mean, we've got all these great stories. In some ways, we kind of mess up ourselves sometimes by separating into different factions, the Democrat, Republican, and stuff like that. But all in all, it's just been a tremendous, tremendous, if you will, ride. All the way from slavery, I like to say all the way from the slave house to the city hall. And, the whole thing was designed on every level to keep us down and in place politically, economically, religiously, socially, and over each and every one of those barricades, we have rose up.
Mr. Becton, talk about the impact of the National Convention of 1830 here in Philadelphia, which at that time was the largest free black community in the North. Talk about the impact of that convention, who was there, things discussed. Talk about that.
Well, this is the first one, and it's down here at Mother Bethel again, right? So, Richard Allen, he's pretty much in charge of this first one. We're going to bring everybody in from all over. Now, of course, our big guys who come in are the New Yorkers. New Yorkers are like, come on, you don't really know how to do it, blah, 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 blah. But the basic idea is that we agreed on things like some people going back to Africa and finding another place where we might stay. There were people who talked about Haiti, and Haiti as one of the, the first free nation in the Western world. Of course, remember back to 1804 when Desai Lane said that any African puts his foot on the soil of Haiti will be absolutely free. And he took the French flag, tore it in half, took the white section out, said, sew the red and the blue back together, that would be the flag of Haiti. So people were talking about Haiti. They were talking about how things weren't going real well around here. David had just finished his book. Wasn't it? David wrote that book and they hated him so much.
David Walker.
Oh, Walker and Peele.
David Walker. He had just written his book, too. So that was steaming.
Was he in attendance?
I don't know.
I think he died in 1831. I was just curious. Okay.
Yeah, no.
As a matter of fact, I don't have a list of everybody who was in attendance.
Okay.
You know, a few of the big guys that they seem to mention. I almost had to dig it out. I'm going to say McCormick. I'm going to say Fortin wasn't there. I don't know why Fortin did that too. He did strange things like that. He made his own group called the American Moral Reform Society, which was an integrated group, and he was going to reform the morals of America. I don't know why he did that. This is baffling to me. There are white members too. There. Oh, gee, I'm sorry, sir. I can't just roll off a bunch of names.
No, it's no problem. I just want to understand the impact of what was going on during that period with some of our ancestors that formulated that convention.
The impact was major, major, major. We had that reattachment to Liberia, because Liberia had been out there about 10 years by then. We had the idea that we were going to move back to Haiti. What was it? The guy, Joseph, the president of Haiti, his name was Joseph, too. He was because Haiti went through a time from emperors, and then back to present. Boyer, Joseph Boyer, that's his name. So Joseph Boyer, thinking about him, people about thinking about going out west. Of course, the Seminole Wars are jumping off on the second level right then, right? So 1832, the Seminoles getting into a second war with the United States, which they win. Of course, there's the third war with the United States in 1842, which the Seminoles also win. So, you know, these are stories that we don't get to hear about because, you know, it's just, I don't know, incorrigible, I guess.
Let's grab a call. 267 area code, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
What's up, Elliot? How you doing?
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Good show. Listening back, Elliot. How you, Brother Richard? Listening back. Hello to your guest, Elliot. Just listening and stuff, man. Just sticking it up. I'm just going to just finish it. I just tuned in a few minutes ago and stuff down here in the shoreline. I forgot to stop and, you know, listen for the rest of the show, Brother Elliot. That's all.
Okay, then.
All right. Thanks, Elliot.
Thank you for your call.
You're welcome.
Mr. Becton, before I transition to Octavius Cato and talk a little bit about him, the leaders at that time, we can see a different mentality among our people during that period that has kind of gotten lost now. And maybe it's because of our people thinking in their minds that they've finally arrived or been accepted. But you had our people then that was in a state of semi-freedom in the North that had a care for their brethren that were enslaved, and that were always looking for ways to help their enslaved brethren. They didn't have a mentality of, well, I'm free, you're on your own type of thing. And that's why I was talking about that convention of 1830. That care for our brother, being our brother's keeper, was something that was in our people even before we came here to these shores. But I think it has been lost since we've been here. Talk about that in your opinion.
I have to agree. And, you know, a lot of people don't like the way I put it, but we have a tendency to be civilized. You know, civilized. That's our tendency. If this is the law, we will follow the law because that's what a civilized person does. Okay? The law is wrong. Okay, well, we're going to go through whatever machination that we have to go through to make the law be what it should be because we're civilized. Right? So, as civilized people, you know, we care about others. One of my favorite stories is about Lenai Lenape, who went to London. And he's in London, and people are taking him all around, bringing him in the house, feeding him all this fantastic food. But he's concerned because right outside the door, there's somebody starving to death. And the Lenape wouldn't do that. You know, if one eats, they eat, you know. Mm-hmm. They all might not all eat good, but they eat. And that's being civilized. That's being human. Ignoring another person's humanity as you feast, it's not being civilized. That's being barbaric. You know, and that's the kind of stuff that we've been taught. We've been taught to be barbarians. You have a problem with somebody, you take your double-bladed axe and you hit him in the head. You know, that solves the problem. That's not civilized. That's barbaric. So we're living inside this barbaric framework. And, of course, when we had our own communities, we were closer to our own children, we could show them, you know, that's not what you do. You know, that's a bad person who does that. But now, they have invaded our living rooms, they've invaded our minds. They tell you that they are more, they tell your children that they are more important than you are. Yeah, that you don't know what you're talking about, and that this is the way of the world, to be barbaric, to steal, to rob, to burn, to rape. That's the way of the world, because man is evil, and that's the way of the world. So, we're all caught up in this way of the world. We all want gold. Well, gee, a gold is nice, but what do you do with it in the end? You can't eat it. But
and you can't take it with you.
Gold is what we need. You know? We need Mercedes. We need gold. Hey, do we need spiritualism? Do we need love in our community? No, what is that? What is that? That's stupid, love in your community. So this is what we're faced with. As we've been taught, I assume forever, to be civilized
And then we're in this uncivilized state where war, murder, the condition of the day, and of course, what makes it the most horrible, if they take the war and murder, try to reflect it on us and say that we are the murdering warriors instead of those people who bomb countries, steal oil, who murder people around the planet every day, who starve people out just so they can make a profit. So that's how I see it, that they flipped it. One of my teachers is a Moore, Albert L. Lockhart, and he says, sometimes to understand history, you must take the belt buckle and turn it upside down, and then you'll really see what's going on.
If I might say, Elliot, to the question you asked, and I wanted to ask Joe about that, because it seemed that those conventions showed that we were able to do the self-governing. I mean, we came up with as you demonstrated, a lot of different things. So those men coming from, you know, those areas coming together in Philadelphia, it was the beginning of the governing mechanism, because they were setting policies, weren't they? As far as what they thought Africans should do and were going to work to do.
It was very forward thinking. As you know, though, as we go down the road, then the Philadelphians and New Yorkers start to argue. New Yorkers want to have it over there. Philadelphians want to have it over here. I think one time they got it out in Buffalo one time. So they kind of spread it around and moved it around. I think William Howard Day was big in that, too. Remember him?
William Howard Day? Yes.
Yeah, from Pittsburgh?
Right.
Yeah, I think he was in there, too.
Okay.
I don't know if Delaney made it to that meeting or not, but
I think he came later. And that seemed like they were another generation.
You're right, because Delaney takes that trip to Africa in 59.
Right.
And we're talking about 30, but that's quite a distance. It's quite a distance.
Let's take it up to talk about Octavius Cato, Mr. Becton. You know, when I was young and going to school, the only thing that was basically known by my peers about Octavius Cato is that Cato was the worst school in Philadelphia, where it was a disciplined school, and folks didn't really know anything about Octavius Cato. Talk about him as a man.
I'm the same way right here in West Philly, and you know, my first question is, how could my teachers let that happen? I mean, that Cato wasn't that old. What was that? The building was like, 1950s. So, I don't know how they let that happen. But, yeah, that one of our greatest heroes, you know. Teacher, sportsman, military man, his own baseball team, one of the first teachers at the male teachers at the Institute for Colored Youth, which eventually turned out to be Cheney University. How many stories can I tell? When the Civil War starts, he takes his students out of class, I think it's like 7th and Catherine where the school was, and says, come on, we're going to go and fight. The Confederates are coming to Pennsylvania. So they march on over to Racing Bar to the armory, and they get uniforms, guns, they get on the train, take the train all the way to Harrisburg. They get to Harrisburg, and they're holding a lot of the bad guys who come in from all over the state together. And I guess the guy's name is Couch, Darius Couch. It's a general. He comes out and says, look, y'all guys, I don't know who told you to come here. I know you can't read, but this is a 90-day enlistment, and y'all can't sign up for 90 days in Pennsylvania. You got to sign up for 3 years with the feds. Let us have those guns, y'all go back home. Now, of course, it was his assumption that they couldn't read, but actually, they could all read. They came from the Institute of Colored Youth. And they knew what it said, but they went to respond to the call to protect their state. So, after that, Octavius doesn't join the army immediately. He does a lot of recruiting, and then at the end of the war, he joins the Pennsylvania Militia, and he gets the rank of major, right? So, that's one of the levels of the stories about Octavius. Here's another one. He's at the school. So he's at the school, and the Quakers are in the school, so he says, I'm a man, and, you know, this lady over here, you know, she's getting paid as much as I am. He says, it's just not way. It's just not the 19th century way. So they give him a raise, right? I was out listening to Eleanor Jones Lepsinski, and she was talking about that particular incident. She said, see, he was just a racist. It was really messed up. So she didn't like him very much. Ellen doesn't. That's another story about him. About the baseball team, all right? The always things, and way back there at the time, right after the Civil War, it's like, no, we don't want to play baseball with you black guys because, you know, you're black guys. We don't play with you. So he sets up a game to play with the Athletics, all right? They get almost to the game, and for some reason the Athletics cancel their thing. He does get to play against another white team in Philadelphia called the Olympics, and they played, and I can't seem to find out who won, so I don't know what to say about it. But, of course, when I was talking with it about it with other historians, I said, well, who cares who won? I said, well, everybody cares who won. I said, that was the whole point. Did the black guys beat the white guys? But still, yet to be told as to whether the Pythians, as they called their team, won or whether they lost. And, of course, that started a tradition of black baseball here in Philadelphia that went all the way to the Philadelphia Stars.
Okay.
Yep. So, as a sportsman, as an educator, he also spoke at least two languages, English and Latin. As an educator, as a sportsman, as a political activist, they had the Equal Rights League. Oh, man, that's one of my favorite stories, too. The Equal Rights League. So here in Philadelphia, they're protesting the fact that the horse-drawn trolleys, you know, don't let black people ride inside. You can pay a nickel, you ride outside. You can hang on, but you can't ride inside. Of course, Robert Small's story is a very famous story. He came to Philadelphia to get his ship repaired. While he was here, he went up to Camp William Penn to see how they were training black troops, because he had seen black troops being trained in South Carolina. So he gets way up there, and of course, to get back down, he has to get on the trolley. He gives the guy the money, gets on the trolley. The guy tells him he's got to hang on the outside. He said, well, I don't want him hanging on the outside. A couple of the toughs got with him, and they threw him off the trolley, right? So Robert Smalls, national hero, thrown off the trolley in Philly. So this just adds more wood for the fire for our agitation against the segregated trolleys. By right after the Civil War, 1866, most of the private trolley system had broken down and allowed for black people to ride inside the trolley for paying their money. So, last but not least, he's a military guy, and we're getting our right to vote. A lot of people don't realize it, but when Pennsylvania started in 1776, black men who owned property, who were over 21 years of age, could vote. It didn't say in our Constitution white yet. It didn't say that. So, in some places, people voted. One of our most famous citizens, James Fortin, apparently couldn't vote in Philadelphia. In 1790, he talks to a guy named Samuel Beck. Samuel Beck owned the Sweetbriar Mansion over here at the Sweetbriar Turnoff. The building's still there. And Fortin is telling him, well, I've got 19 white workers and I've got 11 black workers, and my white workers vote for whoever I tell them to vote for, and they voted for you, Samuel Beck. So when I first read the story, I was like, well, why is this relevant? Why did he even say this to this guy? And then I realized that the gang boys are standing in front of Independence Hall, and you come up to vote, you got to fight your way up to the window, and you got to fight your way away from the window. In those days, on election day, the politicians used to get everybody drunk. And, of course, that's why it's the rule today where you're not supposed to be selling any liquor on election day. So Philadelphia was typically riotous on election day because the gang boys were drunk, and they're standing out in front of the polls, stopping the people who they don't want to go in. 1870, we get the right to return to vote. Black men get the right to return to vote. That first year, the Marines come out, and they stand at all the polls, and they keep everybody quiet. The second year, 71, the Marines don't come out. The gang boys go crazy. Cato is down right across the street, really, from Mother. Bethel. That's where he voted at. He comes back out, and of course the fighting and rioting is going on. He's going home to get his guns and get his militia group. On the way home, he gets ambushed and shot and killed. So they say that it was one of the biggest funerals, multiracial funerals, for a guy like him, an intellectual, a sportsman, a gentleman, you know, just all these great things. And, of course, in the 1960s, the 70s, all we knew was it was Cato College, School of Knowledge. You didn't want to go there in any circumstance, and we had no idea that this man was a great intellect, hero, everything.
Wow. Let's go to 602 area code. What's your name? Where you calling from?
Yes, brother. Good evening. This is Brother Marcus from Memphis calling.
How are you, Marcus?
I'm doing great, and good evening to your guests.
Good evening, sir.
Yes, brother. I am love the information you're giving, and it's the history of resistance for African people. However, I want to ask a question. Given this history and given the treatment that we have seen over these hundreds of years with these Europeans, I would like to ask, if you really see a future here for black folks here in America, given the treatment, and if we should continue to try to get along with these white folks, given the history, or should we embrace a program like Mr. Garvey's program as a solution? Because we see the fratricide, we see the gentrification, we see this thing here with Trump may start a war, a nuclear war. We don't know. And we are here caught up with these folks. So I would like to, you know, hear your views as a historian looking back and, you know, giving your, if you could give me your perspective on which direction we should go. Stay here with this man, try to get along with him. For the last 400 years, we've been trying to get along. Or should we change and get a different, go in a different direction, you know, back to our motherland where we can be in our own environment where we control? Because this environment, you see, we don't control it. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Marcus, thank you for your call.
Okay, brother, thank you.
Yes, sir. Well, you know, sir, a very, very important question, right? Should we stay or should we go? Now, we've been going, we've been staying, and I think that now the world is so small that it doesn't matter if you go or if you stay. Our last president did some very interesting things in Africa, kind of getting everybody to look over here while different things are going on over there.
Okay.
So, even if we go, they're still there on your back. They're still there on your back. So, I mean, we've got a lot of people who gave us great teachings, okay? There's a Noble Drew and Mr. Farah. There's Elijah Muhammad talking about economic independence, developing own companies, your own businesses. Internationally, as Marcus Garvey would say, with his North Star line, so we would be international and not the idea that we were stuck here, but that we will move around the world. I don't know about you, but I'm hearing about NAFTA, and I'm hearing about Southeastern trade. I'm not hearing them saying a trade with Africa. What is that? What is that? What is going on? We know that there's a cobalt. We know there's diamonds. We know there's oil. So why is there no African trade union with America? So this is a place where we could all step in. This is a place where we could invest, where we could have our own businesses, as Garvey would suggest. So I think that the plans have been laid out. I think we need to remember our plans. If we think about plans for everyone, then things can help. But as long as we stay bent on this individualism, it's my dollars, it's my plan, it's my million, it's my big house, as long as we stay on that, we won't be able to become international. And if we don't become international, well, you'll see what's going to happen. We're just going to listen to the same thing. We speak one language. Because we speak one language, we get one source of information. We know that source of information is typically not too good. English is not too good. But we will meet somebody else and say, you don't speak English, you idiot. We are so brainwashed and tied up into the foolishness that we missed the point. We should be speaking English, French, Swahili. This is what we should be doing, and so we can be international. So that international thing is going to be very, very important. Each one of us needs to pick up extra languages. Each one of us needs to travel around the world to learn our world story and to make those world connections. Because we have wealth here that seems minuscule to us, but when you take it around the world, we're very wealthy.
Mr. Buckton, let's bring it up to today, because we see something going on in Philadelphia that's going on in major cities all around this country and smaller cities. Where the neighborhoods that were traditionally African-American are being gentrified. Philadelphia is a little different than other cities in being that it's an old city, one of the oldest in this country, and blacks have almost been here almost as long as whites. Talk about the first neighborhoods that blacks were here in and where they have moved to and evolved to since we've been here. And it seems as though we've been shifted around. We don't have communities where we are and we stay and we own the homes. It seems as though that at the whim of white folks seem like we've constantly being moved around, and it's happening again. Just talk about some of the early neighborhoods where we were always at, especially neighborhoods in South Philly. As far as I know, we were there. But talk about it from your perspective as a historian.
Well, in the beginning, you know, because like this whole community segregation thing gets to be strong in the 19th century. But before that, you know, the wealthy people lived on the tree streets and on the number streets. And the poor people, Irish, Africans, lived in the alley streets. Right? So, the alley streets were everywhere. The first kind of big concentration is going to happen right where our visitor center is right now. So, the visitor center, the federal building, the Federal Reserve Bank, those were Center Street, South Alley, North Alley, Apple Tree Alley, and all in there. So, there's a lot of great stories. There was a black school teacher who came from England in 1790, and she had Eleanor. She had her own school right back there, Eleanor Harris. So she taught 40 black children right over there off of South Alley. So that's 1790. So there's a lot of great stories. Now, not a completely black neighborhood, because a lot of Irish lived in it, Indians lived there, poor whites lived there. Richard Allen's wife lived there. 6th Street, right off of Market. So that's where she lived. Van Dyne's was their name. Right, so that's one neighborhood that kind of formulates. Once again, remember, the number streets and the tree streets tend to be wealthier people. So Walnut, Locust, Pine, Spruce, Sassafras. Come on, there's another one. One more. Yeah, but those tend to be wealthy people streets. The number streets tend to be wealthy people streets, and then the alleys in between seem to be where other folks live.
Okay.
So, now, what happened was South Street was always kind of declared as like the end of Philadelphia. Sometimes they called it Cedar. Sometimes they called it South. So, at South Street, anything could happen. We had theaters. We had tippling houses at South Street. And then just across South Street, in the beginning they called it Shipping. Today we call it 15th and Bainbridge. Today we call it Bainbridge.
Okay.
So that Bainbridge Street was an early black community. James Fortin owned property there. His sister owned property there. The first African Presbyterian was built right there. So right there in that 4th to 5th to 6th to 7th in Bainbridge, that was all a little black community in there. So by the time we get to the end of the Civil War, they've kind of got it organized. They're going to push us into Lombard Street, and this is even the wealthy blacks. We're going to be pushed into Lombard Street, the alleys around South on either side, and that becomes our new neighborhood. By the time William B. Du Bois gets here, they're calling it the District, the 7th District.
and there's a guy, Mr. Ball. I always like to call him Bill Ball, but I believe his real name was Gil Ball. And he was the Republican boss in that area and handled everything and introduced, the young Dubois to the city and, gave him some direction on how to write his Philadelphia Negro, which was a sociological study.
Okay.
So that kind of tells us, so when we look at South Philly, all right, so when I grow up, we're like, oh, don't go to Fifth and South. There's a horrible gang there. They're going to beat you up really, really bad. So the Fifth and South, 13th and South, 15th and South, or 15th and Bainbridge, were all part of the black community. And that's I think that's the first place we get that heavy segregation going on. There was something on the other side of Market Street where they did a whole Chinatown thing, too, where anybody who was Asian had to live inside the framework of Chinatown. Of course, I'm sure they didn't feel they weren't feeling that if they were Korean and Japanese and stuff like that.
Okay. The areas of West Philadelphia, West Oak Lane, a lot of those areas, talk about the people that moved to those areas and the earliest people that moved to those areas, because now those areas are rapidly being gentrified, West Philadelphia, South Philly, and areas of North Philadelphia. But talk about those areas and our people being in those areas long time. How long have our people been in those areas?
All the time.
Okay.
All the time. Let's see. Let's start with West Philly because that's where I live. So in West Philly, we've got the census of 1790. We've got four or five black families, free black families living in West Philly. And so we got their names and their approximate addresses. West Philly was kind of like a place where they would want to send people who they didn't want around.
Okay.
So hospitals were built over here. Sane asylums were built over here. As a matter of fact, I guess the biggest land tract that was left was the one that went to the Pennsylvania Hospital, which started at 51st Street and ran all the way back down to 42nd Street and touched the market and all the way back over to Haverford. So this was one big giant, if you will, sane asylum, so they could send people over here to get rid of them. And the Philadelphia General Hospital was a part of that complex, too. Now, down on the river itself, we had businesses all over the river, ice houses and things like that. The guys would come down the river from Pottstown and from Reading, right? And they would get down to Philly, and these guys along the Schuylkill try to buy their products off of them so they could bring them into town, give them the avoid that last canal loop around the Schuylkill, Fairmount Dam, and then down to the city. So they tried to get them to sell them stuff all up in here in West Philly. So because of the river, the canal was called the Schuylkill Canal, and because of the Lancaster Pike, the Belmont Pike, West Philly is like a confluence of all these different roads. The Baltimore Pike, Baltimore, the Lancaster Pike, Lancaster, and the Schuylkill River, Reading, and those places. So everybody kind of melded right here before they went across the ferries, the big bridges in town to the market. So we've got guys over here who are digging the roads. We've got guys over here who are digging the canals, who are operating the canals. We've got people who are operating the ferries. So there's a number of interesting businesses that are going on this side in West Philly by black people. By 1825, we've got our first Baptist church, our first black church in West Philly, the Blockley African Baptist Church, 41st and Ludlow. There's still a church on that spot right now that was built in 1865, and there's a for sale sign on it right at this moment.
And that was a black church? It was always a black church, you're saying?
Always a black church at 41st and Ludlow. The African Baptist Church of Blockley, 1825.
Okay.
Now, a little bit further up, we've got the Tutlow Grove, and that's at 54 from Baltimore. And they used to have camp meetings out there. So this is a new thing that I'm just finding about. The wonderful historian Sheila Jones has helped me identify exactly where it is, at 54th and Baltimore. So I just ran across that in one of Jim Lang's books about Philadelphia, under the Dorseys, William Dorsey's Philadelphia. So there's still a lot of things to be found. Now, over here in West Philadelphia, when we get into that Underground Railroad era, we've got Stephen Smith and William Whipper. Stephen Smith and William Whipper operate out of, name of the town? Not Lancaster, but Columbia. Columbia, Pennsylvania. They did very well down there in the 1830s. But when the Depression in the 1830s started to hit very hard, people attacked the black owners. Obviously, because he's rich, the Depression is, you know. He made the Depression, so let's burn him out.
Okay.
Anyway, he buys some railroad cars, and they move to Philly, and they start sending their coal and their lumber from Lancaster to Philly on railroad cars. He says that he had fake apartments inside his railroad cars, that he would put people who were escaping on the Underground Railroad in the fake compartment, fill up the rest of the car with coal and or lumber, and then drive it on through to Philadelphia. So we've got that connection. Of course, way up here on the hill, we've got the Belmont Mansion, and they have their own special Underground Railroad Museum. So because of those kinds of things, we end up with a graveyard right here. Stephen Smith builds his home for the colored aged and infirm and a black graveyard. Now, the graveyard opens in 1849, and guess who's here for the grand opening? Frederick Douglass. That's right. Fred came in for the grand opening. He wrote in his North Star paper that this was the first black-owned graveyard for black people in America. I think Fred got a little bit exaggerated there, but it's just marvelous that he was here. Oh, by the way, the name of the cemetery was Olive Cemetery, and it sat where the Stephen Smith home is and the Blankenberg School sits today.
And to bring that current, as Elliot was raising, and show, again, another aspect of Joe's involvement where history becomes really active, can you just give a little bit of what you had tried to do and what the city was doing with Stephen Smith's space, the cemetery and all, and what you were trying to get the city to preserve, I guess is the way to put it.
Yeah, well, Stephen Smith, William Whipper, his wife, Lucretia Mott and James Mott, they all kind of put money together to build this home for the colored aged and infirm. First, Stephen Smith said, oh, I'll leave some money, somebody else can do it. But his wife, Harriet, kept bugging him, no, you're going to do this. You do this. You got all these people out of slavery. Now they don't have no place to die. You open up a senior citizen's home. So he did open it up in 1870. He died soon after he opened. So black money, black hands, for black people right here in West Philly. All right, here we are in 2010. I've been telling my neighbors for years, hey, look, we got to watch out for this building because this building tells our story in this neighborhood. This is not just an ordinary neighborhood. Yeah, my neighbors are, yeah, shut up. So sure enough, I wake up one morning in October 2012, and they're knocking the building down, So, I immediately run out and say, hey, you can't be doing this, blah, blah, blah. This is a graveyard, sacred ground. The workers are like, well, go talk to so-and-so, talk to so-and-so. So I went around, talked to a few of the people. One of the folks who operates out of the new Stephen Smith home, which they now call Centennial, said, well, the old building was filled with rats, so we had to knock it down. Well, I live around the corner from the old building. If it was filled with rats and you knocked it down, I think I would have seen the rats running in front of my house. But nonetheless, they knocked it down. I asked one of our local council people about it. And they were like, what building? What are you talking about? So the way that that building was situated, there's a Cunningham building on one side of it, the old firehouse on one side of it. They built a new chapel in front of it and a 1960s building on the north side. So I'm assuming that they figured they could knock this building down and nobody would ever notice. And I did notice, of course. I wrote to the Scoop. I wrote to the Tribune, the Inquirer, Adam,
Aaron Womits from the University of Pennsylvania, one of the public historians over there, he got into writing. We didn't even know each other at the time, so we were kind of writing from different ends and different angles. And then they knocked the building down and they stopped. So they have never put a replacement building there, and it's just an empty hole. Interestingly enough, around the corner at 40th and Memorial, or Parkside and Memorial, is what they call the German Apartments. At the same time they were knocking the Stephen Smith home down, they were refurbishing the 1904 German Apartments. So, of course, the German Apartments are nice and beautiful, and Stephen Smithville home is gone. So this is just a kind of example of the kind of problems that we have all across our city. At one time, down on Lancaster Avenue, we had the Dr. Charles Drew School, right? Charles Drew is an African-American involved with developing blood transfusions. They knocked the school down. Is that a way to destroy our story? Or is the next building that they're going to build going to be called Charles Drew too? I don't know. I'm working on that so maybe we won't lose our story of Charles Drew. But, you know, sometimes people say that we need to go and knock down history that we don't like. Be careful knocking down history that you don't like. Because when you knock down history that you don't like, you're actually destroying the story of what happened. And the reason that you don't like it is because of the story. And when the story disappears, then your history is gone, and you don't even know why you don't like it.
You know, I'm glad that you were here to kind of give us a backstory on our people's existence here in Philadelphia, which is an old city, and our people have been here almost since day one. But, you know, when you see these things happening, especially now, Mr. Becton, I know it's heartbreaking to you to see blacks in positions of power that do nothing about our people being pushed around, pushed out of neighborhoods. In fact, some of them are willing participants in their people being displaced. Just talk, you know, in the few minutes that we have left with you, talk about how you feel as a historian and knowing how some of their predecessors felt about our people that were enslaved at that time. And you see our people now in positions of power that are willing participants in our people being gentrified out of these neighborhoods. What did you just talk about? Just give me your honest feelings on that, Mr. Becton.
Well, number one, we had to fight and fight and fight to get into these neighborhoods. You know, the stories of the 1940s and 1950s with the fights with the Irish and the Italian and the Jews. And I mean, literally, you know, North Philly, block by block, people fought to move in. West Philly, black block by South Philly, sometimes they still fight in South Philly, you know, block by block. So, you know, we fought, we struggled to move to these places so we could be in these places. And then somebody flipped the card. They said, hey, these places are no good. You need to be in the suburbs. We're building some nice styrofoam houses out there. Come on. $300,000, come on out to the suburbs. You know, it's dangerous in the city. It's nice in the suburbs. And here we are. I mean, just almost like every time the media tells us something, we believe it. Those are styrofoam houses. These houses are made of brick and mortar. And they're telling me, well, your house is only worth $40,000. They know good and well 5 years from now, the whole thing is going to flip. It's going to be worth $145,000. And they know that.
Okay.
But they're telling me to sell for $40,000 so I can go out to get a $300,000 cardboard house that is going to fall down within 50 years. It's going to fall down. They know it. And we just suck it up and we just go because whatever they say is better than what we have. It's a shame. Once again, in my thing that I'm trying to teach kids in West Philly is that we have the good properties. We have the good space. We are close to Center City. We're close to all the cultural highlights of the city. You know, they want to move to the other side of the Blue Route where there's nothing. And unfortunately, that's what we're doing. That's what we're doing. You know, we let the law enforcement go down in our communities to the point, you know,
where everybody says it's just too dangerous to even be here. I don't know. I don't live in the suburbs. Maybe people's houses in the suburbs don't get broken into. Maybe their cars don't get stolen. Maybe their kids don't get addicted to drugs. I don't know. I don't live there. But somebody's got that story going, and we're all buying it. And we've been, in the beginning, it was a fight to get here. But now, once again, they flip the script. Here is no good. You need to be over there. So let's see how many of us go over there. How many of us sell out at 40, and then they turn. Well, we saw it down South Philly. We're watching it right now in South Philly. $40,000 house now $200,000.
Yes.
You know, and it's going to happen in West. It's going. The only reason it's not happening now because we're still here. They want us to get out before they raise the price, so we don't even get the benefits from the places that we lived for 50 years, for the fights that we fought to get into this neighborhood, and now. Now it's all. Let's move out. Let's knock it down. Anytime somebody moves out of a house, boom, knock it down. Why? Because we're going to build a cardboard house and we're going to sell for $200,000. So it's realtors got to make money too. They got to live too. But to a certain degree, it's up and very important for us to understand what we have, what it's worth, and what the trend is. Because they will move us. We will all be, I'm telling you right now, we will all be sitting at Chester Springs in little cardboard houses with nowhere to go. They're closing the malls. It used to be when you'd be in the suburbs. They're closing the malls. So you'll just be out there, sitting there, I guess, without police protection, starting all over again, I guess.
And that's why, you know, the history of Black Philadelphia is, like, really important. And to the question you raised, Elliot, and to the response you gave Joe, is, like, really critical to look over that 1835. When you talk about, it was, if you have the principle of defining what freedom is for yourself, and you have the men and women who are organized and they're self-governing. I mean, that's what the conventions were, right? They were self-governing mechanisms. You had the political mechanism that governed the city, the state, and the federal system. But Black people had to create their own mechanism of self-governing. And in defining freedom, you define freedom, this is your place. And you need to have references, not for just what you do, but so that the future can see what you do. And that's when you were saying, Joe, about these places that are being torn down, or these are our historical markers. We have to celebrate them. We have to define them. We have to support them, because we know, and we know that others, even when you were talking about Gil Ball, who was a Black Republican in the 1850s, 60s. Who were working for the Republican Party. He was the party boss, and his role was to control the political mechanism of Black people and turn it over to, and I forget the Irish political boss that had the gangs and whatever. When we don't know that history, we don't understand that we are looking at the same controlling mechanism.
Over and over today. And over.
Right.
Wow. Mr. Becton, I want to thank you for being with us this evening. But before we leave you, talk about the tours, how young people can get involved, how they can reach you. Any information you want to give out, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much. I'm just glad that you guys gave me an opportunity to talk like this. You know, I'd like to remind everybody, you know, there was a time when we could not talk like this. Literally, they would come out, they would find you, they would get you. So, you know, with all the problems that we do have, you know, right now, they don't search us down and kill us in the streets anymore. They don't hang us anymore for having an opinion or having something said. So, that may not continue to be, but right now, we can say it. One of my teachers is a guy from the West Indies, Erskine Dotton. He was from Barbados. He said, you could say whatever you want to say. He said, but here's the problem.
when people begin to listen to you, then you begin to have a problem. So that was what he said, and of course, exactly where you guys are standing at. You know, people are listening to you, and I just, you know, wish you the best. Now, over here, my regular tours, I do regular tours of Philly, Valley Forge, Trenton, Washington's Crossing. I do have, some, if you will, some work for adults who want to be tour guides. Takes a little while to kind of get worked into the system until people know you and they start calling for you. But I do have my own training systems. In terms of public tours, on June 10th, I have my Washington Square Tour or Congo Square Tour. I call it the Short Black History Tour of Philadelphia. We start at 12 o'clock. We maneuver around right in the area till 2 o'clock. So that's June 10th, starting at Congo Square, which is better known as Washington Square, 12 o'clock. That one is $20 for adults, $5 for children. Nope, the short one. That one is $10 for adults, $5 for children. Now, the long one is Joe Becton's Revolution. That happens on July 8th. And we start at 10 o'clock with that one, and we end at 2 o'clock with that one. So that's a long one, but it's really worth it. We go by Absalom Jones' house, Richard Allen's house, through to Congo Square. Of course, talking about connections with the Declaration of Independence. People don't realize it, but the Declaration of Independence is not a freedom document. So we have that big discussion about what does independence have to do with freedom. And there's reenactors on that day and music. So that's a big day. That's the day that's $20 for adults, $5 for kids. Over here in West Philly, we're working on our tour coming up Lancaster Avenue, starting like at 34th Street around the old Quaker meeting and moving up 34th Street, telling the stories of the Lancaster Pike, of the Black community coming into West Philly, the struggles that they had with the various companies, seal tests, and these guys in the 20th century, about their ice houses along the river, about their churches that they made here in West Philly, and ultimately about the mansions, too, because even in the mansions, there's stories of the Africans who worked there, who lived there. I haven't been able to find about building, but I suspect they also built those mansions, too. So, that's what we have going in West Philly. We want to get young people in to teach them how to do this. They can take first-person impressions. For instance, everybody remembers that at 40th and Lancaster, Martin Luther King, and more. Cecil B. Moore met there, and the famous Freedom Now speech that Martin Luther King made right there. It's a story kind of like the Paul Revere story, like, Dr. King's on the app, Dr. King's on the app, kids running over, Dr. King's on the app. I was on vacation in North Carolina, so I wasn't there, but they tell me thousands of people came out to these cleaners to see Dr. King. So, yes, certainly there'll be some young people who will learn that speech and learn that story and do that impression. So we're going to have all kinds of Western impressions from that era right before Civil War soldiers who came from the area near impressions. We're going to teach them how to do the Islamic Center Museum. Islam in America. We're going to teach them how to do the Paul Robeson House, and we hope to have an establishment and relationship with the Belmont Mansion. So this is our second year doing this. Myself and Abdul Muhammad are kind of heading it up. We hope that young people will join us. Right? So the number is 215-809-5967.
Repeat that again, Mr. Beckman. 215-809-9567. Okay.
Yeah, but that's the direct number, and we'll start signing up young students. Well, we're kind of opening it up from like 14 all the way to 19. And as things get going, there'll be, you know, tours that they can give to make money once they finish their training. And also just the if you will, the techniques for giving tours that they'll learn, they'll be able to apply anywhere they want to go.
Now, Mr. Becton, before you leave us, let me ask you a question. Philadelphia is a tourist city. They make a lot of money from tourism. Is your phone ringing off the hook when you for people to take tours? And especially when we've had two events here in the past couple of years, the Democratic Convention, which a lot of blacks are involved in the Democratic Party. The NAACP had a convention here. Was your phone ringing off the hook during those two affairs in particular?
The NAACP, no. The NAACP runs a very tight conference, or at least appears to me. So they don't like give people any time to do anything except be at the conference.
Okay.
NCC, I did pick up a few jobs with the NCC. Colleges, they came to town, they wanted to participate. Now, I was very interested. I figured, was that the two things? As a matter of fact, the same year as the NCC, I think it was the, the AME.
Yeah, exactly.
AME?
Yeah.
Had, what, 200th anniversary or something? The new Richard Allen statue went up, and, oh, man, all the big bishops were here. So I picked up more during the AME convention. I picked up a few, not politicians, but students around the national convention. Actually, my Civil War group, we were the color guard on Thursday at the Democratic National Convention. So the regiment itself got super, super press. And, of course, we ended up the losers, but we got super, super press at that time. Generally, my business comes to me by word of mouth. People see me in my funny clothes. They hear me downtown. The rumor is I'm the loudest guy downtown. So they see me in my colonial clothes. They hear my loud voice. I play music. I could barely keep myself out of the discussion last time about jazz and blues. I have a presentation that I call The Evolution of the Blues. But I could barely keep myself out of the conversation. It was so stimulating. But I knew my time was coming, and you got to wait your turn, right? Ooh. So that's the kind of thing that we do. We've got music. We've got reenactments. As soon as I get off this phone, I'm going to sleep. Tomorrow morning, I will be in Milford, Pennsylvania, doing a Civil War reenactment at their city hall. So, yes, this is a very busy time. As a matter of fact, you probably tried to call me. It might have taken you a couple of days to get through to me. That's how busy it is. Oh, yes.
Mr. Becton, I want to thank you for being with us and sharing with us this evening. And I'll make sure that we put your information out on our website where people can get a hold of you.
Well, very good, very good. And hopefully, let's give it a couple of months. Talk again. Maybe have some more stories, and I'll probably maybe zero in on a couple of special people for you.
That'll be good. And in fact, maybe I'll try to arrange something where you can be on with Dr. Box and have both of you on together.
Ooh, Yeah, me and a teacher. That'd be great. We've done a few things together.
Okay. Mr. Becton, thanks for being with us this evening.
All right. Well, thank you for having me on the show. Thank you, Richard, and I will see y'all soon.
Yes, sir.
We'll be right back.
Are tuned in to the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts and live program scheduling, visit us on the web at blacktalkradionetwork.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. Sundays, 7 p.m. with your host.
Peace. This is Professor Griff from Public Enemy. People keep saying black people need to do this and black people need to do that. Well, frankly speaking, I think it's a whole lot of talk, a whole lot of philosophy, and a whole lot of head nodding. But where is the action? I'm suggesting everyone that's within the sound of my voice, we need to get on board with this national black economic empowerment movement. Let's Buy Black, 365.com. That's Let's Buy Black, 365.com. This is Professor Griffin, Public Enemy, and I'm out. Peace.
Darkness no longer, a child is born. Mother shed tears of joy as baby tests his lungs. My daddy's not there where he ought to be. Somewhere in Georgia, skinning and shooting craps on his knees. Another victim born out here in the hood. And based on statistics, it really ain't all good. Welfare takes the tab, and daddy can't sign, and it can't be seen, the family becomes a crime. The hunt is on, and brother, you're the prey, serving time in jail, it just ain't the way. I'm living so hard, babe, that my hair's gray. We got to make a change, it's a brand new day.
A new world. Day.
It's a new
a
day.
Change of mind for the human race.
It's
a new
day.
World order, a brand new day.
It's
a change
day.
Of mind for the human race.
Operation in flux, and it's on the way. We just marched a million plus the other day. Look, look, we all witnessed the swift. Rolling down Miss Liberty's head. She knows the sleeping giant. She's no longer sleeping dead. Oh, what a fulfillment of prophecy. Let us teach the children freedom's never been free. It's okay to cry. Go ahead and cry. Cause Jesus wept, but hope and faith be kept. It's a new day.
World order, a brand new day.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. I want to thank our guests for this evening. Jazz percussionist Mr. Joe Harrison was with us in the first hour to talk about the event at Tingen Baptist Church tomorrow, celebrating Jazz Appreciation Month. with celebrating legendary saxophonist Sam Reed, along with others, Young Phenom, Yusef Ali, and friends, vocals by Suzanne Burgess. Ought to be a good event. Admission $20, 17 and under are absolutely free. And that's 12 noon to 4 p.m. at Canaan Baptist Church, which is at 5430 Pulaski Avenue in Philadelphia. After that, it's another event going on Saturday evening. Panel discussion and dinner at the Black Writers Museum, 5800 Germantown Avenue at the Vernon House. Naturals Need Love 2, Relationship 101. It's a panel discussion and dinner. It's a fundraiser for the Locks Conference, and also a tribute to Sharon Goodman and Nana Ansa Wilson Bay. So there's a couple of events going on Saturday, April 22nd. Hope you'll be in attendance. And looking forward to the conversation on Sunday. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir.
It was good having Mr. Becton on to give us a perspective history on Black Philadelphia. Blacks have been here almost since Europeans have been here and establishing this city of Philadelphia and have made major contributions. And it's good to have Mr. Becton on to talk about some of those things.
Yes, it is. It was great. It was great. It was definitely informative as far as being able to really see that then and now is a continuation. And even though we made contributions, we still got work to do.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely right. Looking forward to conversation on Sunday with Brother Baruti out of Ferguson to talk about some of the things going on there politically and some of the moves that they're making politically. I think it'll be an interesting discussion on Sunday.
Yes.
I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Sunday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.